My name is Chris Mullin. I was the Member of Parliament for Sunderland South from 1987 to 2010. I was a junior minister in three departments, and I chaired the Home Affairs Select Committee for 4 years. And I'm also the author of a number of books, the best known of which is A Very British Coup.
Chris, as someone that's been involved in the middle of this for quite a while, can you just, many of us look upon it as a bit of a yes minister kind of world in politics, increasingly so with the civil service lording it over, the sort of permanent government lording it over MPs. Can you just take us through whether you think that's true or not?
Well, it's a bit of a caricature. British governments these days are very, are really prime minister dominated. And it's surprising, or it didn't surprise me anyway, how even very small decisions were questioned from number 10 Downing Street when you think they'd have better things to do.
And what made you decide to change from being a politician to an author?
Well, I'm a journalist by profession. I wrote my first novel, which was A Very British Coup, in 1982, and published three others. So I've always been a writer. I didn't decide to change. I'm just a writer or a journalist who happened to end up in Parliament.
So we've been talking about Harold Wilson and him being eased out in 1976. I know your Very British Coup novel was loosely based on that. So could you tell us about the novel and the reality?
Well, what prompted A Very British Coup was the possibility that Tony Benn might become leader of the Labour Party, and how the establishment might seek to destabilise a Benn-led government. I was on a train coming back from the Labour Party conference in 1980, I suppose, with three people who either were or subsequently became Labour MPs. And we were discussing how the establishment might react to a Benn government. Benn in those days was at the height of his powers. And one of our numbers said, oh, that would make a good subject for a novel. And another one said, well, by the swimming pool in Greece the previous summer, he tapped out four chapters of exactly such a novel. So I thought, well, I better get on with this, and so I did.
But what happened with Wilson? Do you think that informed it to some extent?
Yes, some of the things in the novel had happened. I had an MI5 spy on the Council of CND, and that 2 or 3 years after the novel was published, actually, turned out to be a chap called Harry Newton. I had senior BBC personnel being vetted, and that turned out 4 years later to be the work of a man called Brigadier Ronnie Stonham, who occupied, I think, room 101 in Broadcasting House, stamping upturned Christmas trees on the personnel files of those BBC employees whose careers were not to progress. So, yes, a few of the things, and of course, as you say, there were attempts to destabilise Harold Wilson, and yes, it was all part of that climate.
I mean, during that period, we had things like, the Concorde, and there was a sort of rivalry between Britain and America. Do you think that the Americans played a role at that time? The idea was they were trying to take over the old British Empire role. They were lording it over us, weren't they?
No, I don't think it was the Americans. I think it was some sections of the British establishment who thought that, including actually members of the Secret Services who appeared to think, Peter Wright and his friends, who appeared to think that Wilson was a Soviet agent, and they set about, as Peter Wright put it in his memoir, bugging and burgling their way across London. And then there was General Sir Walter Walker, if you remember, who set up a private army.
Hang on, you can't. I mean, you or I could not go and set up a private army in this country.
Well, he was setting up, he was calling for recruits. I don't know how far he got. I mean, he was a bit of a joke at the time, but he had been the commander-in-chief of NATO Northern Europe. And then there was a more sinister figure called David Stirling, who was the founder of the SAS, who was also recruiting people for basically to deal with the chaos that they confidently expected under a Labour government, and indeed were perhaps going some way to organise.
Now, look, before we talk about your book about the Birmingham pub bombings, I have to ask you about the rise and fall of not Reginald Perrin, but Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, this has echoes, surely, of your experience back in the 70s and 80s.
Well, I don't know of any evidence that that MI5 or the security services or anything tried to undermine him, but they didn't really need to. There were plenty of people in the higher reaches of the Labour Party, including at Labour Party headquarters, who were trying that. And of course, much of our free press. The monstering that Corbyn received was greater even than that Tony Benn did.
And I know as part of your career, you, through my Home Affairs Select Committee, attempted anyway to take on this idea of Freemasonry and its role. Obviously, that's a big part of the aristocracy, the establishment. Can you tell us how that went?
I don't know how big it is. I had the impression it's actually. Its influence is fading, except in one or two professions and some small parts of local government. It's mainly old gents of a certain age, and it's not so interesting to younger people. What I attempted to do, as chairman of the Home Affairs Select Committee, we had some responsibility for the criminal justice system, so I attempted to persuade the government to require magistrates and judges and police officers who were Masons to have to disclose that. And the Masons fought quite a fierce rear guard action. And ultimately, they won, actually, because they threatened to take the government to court and turn the government back down.
Yes, and I can remember in the 1990s, the Church of England also had a bit of a battle with Freemasonry, which it too won. What makes you think it's not influential? I mean, any secret society, the whole point is that you don't even know it's there.
I certainly agree that, especially in something like the criminal justice system, you can't really have some sort of secret society. And I did my best to oppose that. How big it is, I don't know. My impression was, although there were isolated examples, and although it had been a feature, I think, of many of the elite police squads, that it's not such a big issue now. That was my impression, rightly or wrongly.
Well, fingers crossed.
Well,
Anyway,
I like to think that I made it a little bit less fashionable to be a Mason.
your latest book, Error of Judgment, about the Birmingham pub bombs, what made you want to write about that?
A friend of mine called Peter Chippendale, who was a journalist on The Guardian, remarked to me at the time of the trial. He attended the trial of the Birmingham Six, and he remarked to me at the time, which is in 1975, that he thought they got the wrong people, and he came to that conclusion from his attendance at court and also from talking to one or two of the relatives. He said the same about the Guildford Four. So my interest in both those cases was aroused from that time onwards. And I was only an impoverished freelance journalist myself at the time, so I didn't have the resources to conduct a proper investigation. But I eventually persuaded a publisher to commission a book, and Granada Television to take me on the World in Action program, which was the premier documentary series of its day, to take me on and and fund a proper investigation to see if we could destroy the case against these men, or rather to investigate the case against these men. And eventually we succeeded. We made three documentaries. One destroyed the forensic evidence, one undermined but didn't destroy the police evidence, and the third was an interview with one of the actual bombers. That's the point, really. I traced the actual bombers who were alive and well and in Ireland.
This is extremely disturbing, even if back that long ago, such miscarriages of justice can be allowed to take place, particularly when they're so politically charged, Chris.
Well, of course it was disturbing, yes. One has to bear in mind that until 1984, it was possible to send people away for life on the basis of confessions extracted unwitnessed, unrecorded, documented confessions that occurred in police custody and were repudiated the moment the suspect was out of police custody. But courts used to accept confessions in police custody, even though, as I say, they weren't recorded. And that only ended in 1984 with the Police and Criminal Evidence Act, which does lay down rules as to how suspects should be treated. In the 1950s, and probably earlier, we hanged people on the basis of uncorroborated confessions in police custody. Timothy Evans, Derek Bentley, to name but two.
Well, the question's got to be, surely, why? Why would the police go to such an extent to just simply fit someone up almost straight away rather than do a proper investigation?
Well, they get it into their head that they worked out who did it, and they just try to improve the evidence. In the Birmingham case, you see, well, it didn't just depend on the confessions extracted from four of the six. The key evidence was forensic, and it was supplied by a Home Office forensic scientist called Dr. Frank Skews, who told the court that he tested their hands with a test known as the grease test, and that this proved that at least two of them had been in touch with nitroglycerine. Well, actually, it proved nothing of the sort, and as we discovered when we a Granada Television commissioned other forensic scientists to explore Dr. To repeat the tests that Dr. Skews had done, there's a whole range of innocent substances, anything containing nitrocellulose, which is a constituent of varnishes and household sprays. And we also discovered that old packs of playing cards used to be coated with nitrocellulose, and these men, were, five of whom were arrested after getting off a train at Morecambe, had been playing cards on the train journey. And so we tested an old pack of playing cards, and they proved positive. And then we got the producer of the television programme, a chap called Ian McBride, to shuffle the cards for 5 minutes, and then we tested his hands, and he proved positive. Or as Dr. Skews would have put it, there was a 99% chance that Mr. McBride had recently been in touch with nitroglycerine. Well, of course, at that point, the forensic evidence collapsed.
Now, the troubles finally ended in the 90s with three massive bombs in the City of London. The IRA and Sinn Féin had concluded that that was really what needed to be done, that to hit the City of London in the purse in order to bring the troubles to an end. Do you think that was the right conclusion? Because there have been lots of negotiations, so-called ceasefires, which the IRA and Sinn Féin didn't trust at all.
Well, no, I don't think it was the right conclusion. I'm not in favour of planting bombs in public places.
What they were saying was that this ended the bloodshed because they gave telephoned warnings and this was a damaging of property in the city, wasn't it? Rather than the
Well,
killing of
what?
individual people.
There were telephone warnings in the bomb in the Birmingham case, and 21 people were killed and 200 seriously injured. So, telephone warnings don't always work. As I say, I'm completely against planting bombs in public places. And if you do that, you're not entitled to be surprised by the consequences.
Well, the IRA were surprised. They found that that they had actually successfully brought the British government and John Major to the negotiating table, which was finally concluded the troubles, which surely is the right outcome.
Well, it's certainly true that a long period of negotiation, which did lead many years later to peace in Ireland, and I think that's certainly to be celebrated. But I don't think it was necessary. I think both sides fought themselves to a standstill in Northern Ireland, and the IRA certainly concluded that they were never going to defeat the British state by planting bombs, and I think they were right about that too. And I think the British Army concluded they were never going to defeat the IRA. So it was a stalemate, and so it seemed logical to negotiate.
Let's just talk a bit about the present. It's always, I think, useful to hear from our elder statesmen what they make of current events. It'd be nice to see you more regularly as a commentator, Chris, because we've seen enormous changes just this week with the row Friday evening in the White House with Zelensky and Donald Trump breaking out on live television. And now we've got big changes as well in the British aid budget. That money now going towards defence. It's almost as if, well, we don't want to feed you anymore. We'd rather kill you. And I wonder what you make of these changes we've seen over the last week, particularly with the Europeans saying actually we back Zelensky, whereas the Americans definitely don't.
Well, there's clearly going to have to be some sort of realignment. I think that's become quite clear in the last, and the Europeans. The one thing Trump is right about, of course, is that the Europeans should have paid a larger share of the defence budget in Europe and not depended solely on the, or principally on the Americans. But I certainly deprecate the cutting of the international development budget, which I think will have bad consequences. If you're interested in stopping the flow of refugees into Europe and this country, then what you have to do is try to stop the countries around the periphery of Europe from disintegrating. And our aid budget, along with that of others, much of it was directed towards that end. But both the Americans and ourselves now have withdrawn from that, and I'm guessing you've got Sudan that's disintegrating as we speak. You've got Nigeria, increasing numbers of people flowing out of Nigeria, and they're all heading for Europe. Many of them via Libya, which has disintegrated. Tunisia's more or less disintegrated, The only way you could turn the tide is not by repression, it's by helping them establish functioning market economies in their own countries. And that's what we were doing. We were one of the leaders. But I think all that's been dropped, and I'm very sorry that it's a Labour government that's dropped it.
What do you make of Gaza? People saying that maybe when the last of these hostages are released by Hamas, the genocide will simply continue. And I wonder if you think some do, some don't, that this is a genocide that's been going on.
Well, I'm reluctant to use the word genocide, but and opinions are very sharply divided about that. But the scale of the slaughter, it has been appalling, and I'm in, and Israel's behavior disgraceful, and it is a war crime. And yes, I'm sorry that we turn a blind eye to it. We do, and now it started, of course, with Hamas. It started October the 7th. This current bout of mayhem started October the 7th, but it didn't all start on October the 7th. It started probably in 1947 when they began driving Palestinians off their land. And it's led so far to four major wars and several small ones. and I don't see an end to it. It's probably the world's most intractable dispute.
I mean, people point out around the world, not quite so much here in Britain, that both of the biggest problems that some see on the planet, that is, US foreign policy invading whoever they seem to feel like they want to next, whether it's Iraq or Afghanistan or whatever, and Israel, are both creations of Britain.
Well, I think it's actually a creation of the Americans primarily. And it's understandable to some extent because you've got to remember the history is that after the Second World War, given what had happened to the Jews, there were very large numbers of Jewish people who wanted to set up their own state in Israel, and the pressure was very hard to resist. As I say, given what has happened to them. And actually, it was the Americans, it was Truman during the 1948 election campaign who indicated that he would look favorably upon mass Jewish migration to Palestine, with the results we all know about. But yes, it's true, we had the mandate at the time. We couldn't do much about it, though.
Finally, what about Starmer's policies at home? I mean, you've intimated what you make of his policies abroad there, but we've got the care workers last week protesting in London saying national insurance on the care homes is destroying a part of the economy which is already on its knees. You've also got the farmers saying, you know, we don't want to have to sell our land to pay this tax. We're already very much marginalised by the price fixing of the supermarkets, this sort of thing. What do you make of this Labour government's domestic policies?
Well, I think they made one very large mistake in the run-up to the last general election, and one that's going to haunt them and is beginning already to haunt them. And that is that when Jeremy Hunt, who was Chancellor, cut national employees' national insurance contributions by 3%, at a huge cost to the Exchequer, it was a trap. And he challenged Labour to say, well, would you put it up? Back up again? Would you reinstate that if you're elected? And instead of saying we'll make up our minds what to do when we're elected, and by the way, the next election is likely to be fought about the principal issue at the next election is going to be the dire state of the public services and not tax cuts for the already prosperous. Had Labour taken that stand, they'd be in a better position to have raised taxes in order. But instead, they ruled out raising the three main sources of tax: income tax, VAT, and national insurance. And as a result, they've trapped themselves and had to scrabble about elsewhere to try and raise money. Now, and the fact that we're now going to have to spend a lot more on defence has only increased the pressure.
The super giants, I mean, the Amazons don't seem to pay hardly any tax, Chris.
Well, they're very hard to pin down because they're multinational companies and can shuffle their profits around into the lowest tax regimes. But anyway, listening to this conversation, Tony, I think you've obviously got a master plan. What is it?
Well, with mine, I mean, you know, well, of course I don't, but it seems absolutely key to regulate these big multinationals that offshore their profits. They shouldn't be allowed to do that. If they're
Well,
making profit, if
we
they're
can all
making
agree about
profits in
that.
this country, then they have to pay the money, or they shouldn't be allowed to trade in this country.
We can all agree about the problem. It's extremely difficult to pin down, though. And I would certainly, it will require international cooperation, which, and that of course, in particular in the EU, to try and sort this out, but you've got them all. There's no unity. You've got Amazon. Is it based in Ireland, where tax rates are much lower than here, and it's paying Irish taxes on its British business, and that's a conversation we would need to have with the Irish.
Well, I like the way you throw the question back at me. I think that's absolutely the right thing to do in circumstances like that. But didn't this all start with Margaret Thatcher getting rid of exchange controls?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, that's the subject for a program with a more with someone more knowledgeable
But
about
the idea of being able to
economics.
move your money around the world wherever you want, I mean, that surely is at the bottom of the trick that these massive tech giants play, in making money here but paying no tax here.
Well, they don't pay no taxes, but they pay as little as possible, and they do move their profits around. It's not actually a new thing. It happened in the 1970s as well with some of the big pharmaceutical companies, but it's the reason it's been highlighted in recent years is, of course, because of the rise of the tech giants who are gradually accumulating much of the world's wealth into the hands of a handful of people, one of whom, of course, is Elon Musk.
Well, you asked me, I'm going to ask you, what can we do?
Well, as I say, the European Union, if it set its mind to it, could be quite influential here. You could shut them out of our market or limit them, restrict their access to our market unless they play by the rules. And in the case of Ireland, I think they have actually taken Ireland to court in an attempt to stop them undermining the tax rates elsewhere in the EU, with limited success. The best time for having a conversation with Ireland on the subject would be when we had to bail them out after the 2007, or to help bail them out after the 2007 banking crash. But unfortunately, we missed that opportunity.
Could you just share with listeners your website details and the title of your latest book?
My latest book is actually the republished, an updated version of Error of Judgment, The Truth About the Birmingham Bombings. And I also have published a fourth volume of diaries. I published three before. And the current one, which has just come out in paperback, or recently come out in paperback, is Didn't You Used to Be Chris Mullin? And that covers the years 2010 to 2022. It ends with the death of the Queen. So you'll find that. You'll find my take on
I ought to also ask you what you make of Prince Charles becoming king, because he does seem to have rather a different character to Elizabeth, in that, for example, he's getting right stuck in with the problems there are with NATO, whereas you would imagine the Queen would have just let the politicians get on with it.
As a constitutional monarch, of course, he can only do what the government wants him to do. And I imagine the government was quite keen for him to see Zelensky, to host Zelensky the other day. I should think they're all a bit less keen. He'll be a bit less keen to host Donald Trump next year, which I'm sure he'll have to. But I don't think it's in anybody's interests that the monarchy gets too deeply involved in politics.
Okay, and your website, Chris, is
www.chrismullin, MULLIN, XMP, EXMP.com.
Okay, Chris Mullin, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you for having me.